the future of democracy in Turkey.
What it really boils down to on some level is a conflict over two conceptions of democracy.
That conflict boiled over onto the streets this spring. We'll look at what started the pot simmering, plus an intimate street-level view of Istanbul. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. America's Independence Day is a good time to consider what's been happening in a country halfway across the world. Turkey is a democracy, but not all democracies are created equal. Let's start with the Global Ethics Corner from the Carnegie Council. They created this commentary on the internal conflicts that are behind the current crisis.
Turkey's democracy is sometimes belittled as creeping authoritarianism, and it is sometimes extolled as a model. Turkish democracy is distinctive, has deep secular roots, an Islamic coat, and lively social support. But there are structural challenges balancing religious, political, and personal factors. 10 to 15 years in power is not necessarily anti-democratic, although it can be seen as fertilizing arrogance and abuse. The current constitution was written by the military and needs revision. However, a dramatically revised constitution favoring the winners is likely, rather than one framed for the whole society. This could result in authoritarianism by structural reform. Second, the AK party is mildly Islamist, but its opponents fear a hidden fundamentalist agenda. The opposition concern is that toleration for Islam could lead to fundamentalist intolerance. Third, the prime minister for 8 years, Recep Erdogan, has been accused of, quote, getting bossier and less tolerant by the day. He is remarkably effective, and his commitment to democracy seems firm. He also wants to retain power. A constitution rewritten toward a presidential system creates an opportunity for perpetual power, a potential Central Asian presidency for life. It is hubris to expect all democracies to resemble our own. But how should we view political change in Turkey? What do you think? Does Turkey offer hope to those transforming the Arab world? Or is it under threat? This is Joel Rosenthal, president of the Carnegie Council.
Made possible by the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs.
Asla Bali is an assistant professor of law at UCLA School of Law, and she specializes in comparative and international law. She's watched Turkey with particular interest. It is her native country. She was recently in Istanbul, and I asked her what it was like.
The first day of the protests that turned to sort of repression was Friday, the 31st, I guess it was, of May. And on that day, because of the media blackout in Istanbul covering the protests, I actually had no idea that this was going on, and so basically stumbled into it. When I left in the morning, there was an ongoing small-scale protest in the park, which is very similar to many other kinds of protests involving a couple of dozen to, you know, 100 or 120 people. By that evening, although totally unbeknownst to me or anybody else who wasn't physically in the area, it had escalated to a huge confrontation with hundreds, thousands, and eventually tens of thousands of people converging on the square. And then from that Friday night, the 31st, to Saturday, and then all day Saturday, the confrontation and clashes continued. These were unarmed, nonviolent protesters. The source of the confrontation was the excessive force used by the police in the form of water cannon, tear gas, and pepper spray, used in such overwhelming quantities that if you were in any neighborhood, anywhere in the vicinity, your eyes, throat, nose were on fire. You know, there's no avoiding it. It was wafting everywhere through the area, which is a really central part of the European side of the city. And so I sort of stumbled upon this, what amounted to a war zone in a neighborhood that otherwise is extremely both central and bustling and commercial, and also adjacent to some of the poshest districts of the European side, so a place where you would really not expect to be confronted with these kinds of scenes. It was shocking. It was also a moment in which, you know, you had to really take stock of what's happening in the country and try to understand how things had evolved so rapidly while at the same time responding and trying to determine how to proceed yourself in your daily life.
Asla, of course, these things don't just happen, and you've been studying the policies of Turkey. What do you think led up to this?
The actual events, the thing that was the spark, was something that's actually very common in Turkey. So it's difficult to get a permit to organize a protest or a demonstration. And when people engage in protests, they're often sort of spontaneous or organized at the last minute in response to something as it's unfolding, because very often new policies are undertaken with next to no notice. So, for example, you suddenly find that something that's of historic significance in a central neighborhood is being demolished, and you barely had any notice it was going to happen. People then spontaneously respond, and they're dispersed with tear gas or water cannon by the police. So that's a very common story. And what was happening initially was that a set of environmentalists were seeking to protect a park from being bulldozed. Again, a policy that was decided by the government with very little public consultation, and this consultation that existed was inadequate, and people felt that they weren't being given an opportunity to object in time to save this park. So they went and they were met with tear gas. Nothing unusual there. What is unusual is the extent of the crackdown against them and its timing. So these were people who were encamped in this park. The decision to forcibly remove them was taken overnight, and there was a raid, a pre-dawn raid, on them as they were sleeping, and they were attacked with water cannon. Their tents were set on fire, and images of this were captured and became viral in the social media on a Friday in an early part of the summer, and essentially what it produced was an outcry and outpouring of support in the city. So hundreds began to converge on the square, and the government, having already taken the decision to forcibly remove these protesters, which they had failed to do as people came to their rescue and came in solidarity with them, continued down the path that they had begun with ongoing repression and continued use of overwhelming quantities of water cannon, pepper spray, and tear gas. And the consequence was the opposite of what they were hoping. Instead of dispersing the crowd, the more repression was applied, the more it motivated people to actually come out and show solidarity, to the point that the numbers had swelled beyond anything I had seen previously in any protest in the last decade in Turkey. So this was a very substantial response. The response was not necessarily exclusively around the environmental concerns, but rather a response to the repression with which the government met the legitimate sort of dissent that was being expressed to these plans to rebuild the park. And it came on the heels of a series of other events that were comparable protests against urban renewal plans that the government has undertaken. So, for example, in the spring, they had also destroyed a historic cafe that was very iconic of the early period of the Republic with almost no consultation, and then an adjacent cinema, which was an extremely important, again, cultural site of the Republic, theater, and the place where the Istanbul Film Festival was first launched. And when people came out to protest these demolitions and opposed the building of a new shopping center or mall in the place of these historic sites, they were dispersed in the same way. And so there had already been these earlier episodes in the exact same neighborhood. So that was one set of grievances. But there are a whole set of other grievances now that are being given voice to in these protests. There is an extreme distrust of the government's projects because of the lack of consultation and because of the failure of the government to take into account opposition voices. And so what it really boils down to at some level is a conflict over two conceptions of democracy. The one that the government currently exemplifies, particularly the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who understands democracy to be regular cyclical elections at which people express their preferences. And between those electoral cycles, he takes the view that the public should just simply shut their mouths and accept that the government that is elected will rule by decree without any public consultation and without taking account of the opposition. By contrast, the protesters are calling for a much more pluralist conception of democracy, one that's consultative, one in which they have a role not just at elections but throughout the electoral cycle, that they're able to contribute and have some say in the policies that are undertaken by the government. So those are two competing visions of what democracy should mean in Turkey.
And historically, from what you've seen of this administration, how do you think this is going to play out?
Protests, I think it's important to note, and this maybe many American audiences will recognize because they themselves were probably surprised and taken aback by the success of the Occupy Wall Street movement here in the United States. But this is really quite an unprecedented development in the Turkish context, in part because it is very difficult to assemble any large group of people anywhere, in part because this particular assemblage draws together many different strata of Turkish society. So these aren't the usual suspects in any sense. It's not only university students. It's not only people who are in the political opposition. In fact, it's not at all organized along party lines. It's also not primarily organized along the traditional cleavages in Turkish society, for example, ethnic cleavage between Turks and Kurds, or cleavages over the role that religion should have in public life between people who are more religiously conservative and people who favor a much more secular public sphere. These are not the principal lines of division. Instead, it's really much more of a referendum on a style of governance and on a conception of democracy. As a result, I think it has some durable potential. That isn't necessarily to say people are going to stay on the streets indefinitely, but I think it does mean that it's going to be very difficult for this government to move forward and proceed with its plans treating everything as business as usual. And its plans were very grandiose. I mean, for example, this prime minister was contemplating introducing a new constitution in Turkey. Now, a new constitution is something that's generally speaking desirable because the current constitution is quite illiberal and was drafted by a military junta following a military coup in 1980 and is long overdue for repeal and replacement with a much more liberal constitution. However, it's not clear that that more liberal constitution is what this government had in mind. And specifically, the prime minister has multiple times expressed his own interest in moving Turkey from a parliamentary system to a much more presidential system with a centralized executive that commands a much greater degree of control than is currently the case. He's also not made it a secret that he wants to run for the presidency next year. And so it seemed as if he was on course to introduce constitutional amendments and or a new constitution that would produce a presidential system with a much more empowered presidency and then run for that office. And if selected, then we would end up with potentially as much as 10 more years of centralized control under an increasingly authoritarian leader. I mean, again, he's an elected leader, but his personal governance style is quite authoritarian. I think those ambitious projects have now been checked. And that's a change, because since 2011, which is the last time we had elections, when this governing party, the AKP, won a very large proportion of the vote share, they have really been ruling by fiat. They simply announce new laws, pass them with almost no debate. Because they have a sufficient number of seats in Congress, they're able to make substantial legislative reform with next to no consultation. And the response, which is the protest that we see on the street today, has been, if we can't check the government's tendency to rule by fiat in this way through parliament, we will find another way to do it.
Asla Bali is an assistant professor of law at UCLA School of Law, and she specializes in comparative and international law. Up next, a street-level view of Istanbul. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1251. Modern Turkey, as conceived in the 1920s, was a new nation. It would be secular and Western. Its people would look forward, rarely back. Novelist Elif Shafak, who is fascinated by a history her government would rather forget, searches for her nation's modern history on a nondescript Istanbul street where she once lived and worked.
At the first glance, there's nothing extraordinary about the place. Just another narrow, winding street in Istanbul. Only this one sharply slopes down to the Bosphorus, which divides Europe from Asia. From where I stand, I can see that band of water in the distance, a shimmering silver. At the top of the street, nearly hidden behind a green iron fence, stands an ageless tomb. It is the tomb of the saint who protects the street against all evil. Yet, given the street's history, I tend to think this is a saint that has been sleeping on the job. Or perhaps he isn't sleeping. After all, his tombstone is written in the Ottoman script, long ago banished by the engineers of the modern Turkish state in favor of the Western alphabet. Perhaps the patron saint has simply been trying to convey a message from the past, but in a script the new generations can no longer understand. Our conversation with the past has been broken, but our history, our stories lie here, in the layers just beneath our feet. As a storyteller, it is my job to collect them. Right across from the saint stands a small grocery. The owner of the place is a slim, balding man in his 60s. Mehmet is here every day, from early morning till dusk. After dark, his son takes the shift. You can find almost everything here, from pomegranates to laundry detergents, from candy bars to alcohol, which some conservative grocers refuse to sell.
This grocery is open 24 hours. I don't sell much during the day, but at night I sell more. Bread during the day, beer at night.
Other than the usual customers, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, the grocer also serves the Russian and Moldavian working girls living in the grimy hotel up the street.
I treat the same, a child or adult. Someone doesn't have enough money to pay for something. I feel bad and I usually don't ask. Someone says I'm hungry, I give bread. And my children, my kids get angry at me.
He even cares for the street's army of cats, some incredibly majestic, some so miserable. The grocer and I, we look outside to a cascading rain. Water gushes down in a river toward the Bosphorus. Sometimes I think of my old street as a boat traveling through time, a street boat expelling its passengers every few years, only to take on new ones who have no memory of the past. The water streams as if to remind us of how easily things can be washed away on Kazanji. But it's not only rainwater that has been pushed down the steep street throughout its history.
On the 6th of September, there was a nationalist uprising, 1955.
50 years ago, the street was populated by Turks, Jews, Armenians, and Greeks. In 1955, throngs of Turkish nationalists gathered here, chanting slogans and anthems before they razed to the ground virtually every store operated by ethnic minorities. There was so much shattered glass all around that the whole neighborhood glittered like a mirror in the sun. On that day, some among the mob dragged out the newly introduced, pasty white rounded refrigerators and rolled them one by one all the way down our street, cheering with the fall and crash of each machine.
There were wheels of cheese. They rolled it down the street. Because the grocer was Greek, they took his cheese and rolled it down the street. Of all Turkey's neighbors, the Greeks are my favorite. Yes, I am sad. We are sad because we were so fond of them. Also, as a grocer, I was very fond of them. They were good customers. They know quality. The Greeks, they like artichokes a lot. Half of our customers were Greeks and Armenians. They were afraid to stay here. They left Turkey.
In another part of Istanbul, inside the Grand Bazaar, this is Nick, an Armenian jeweler whose family was pushed off the street of cauldron makers. He grew up hearing all about the events of 1955.
Those days was very terrible. Lots of shops are broken, you know, and people were coming like hundreds by hundreds, you know, and they were just like animals, they were crazy, they were breaking everywhere.
He goes to America very often, as he has relatives and business partners in California. He sells pastırma, a kind of spicy pastrami so dear to both Turks and Armenians. I ask him, despite all this that happened, why hasn't he wanted to leave Turkey? Why hasn't he settled in America or elsewhere?
All my relatives, cousins, all friends are there. And each time I go to America, they keep asking me when I'm going to move. And I think I'll never move this country. Sometimes they, when they hear my name, they say, "Are you Armenian?" "Yes." "When did you come?" I said, "I was here before you come. We are here since 3,000 years.
The ethnic minorities weren't the only ones our street boat disgorged. During the 1970s, the street of cauldron makers became notorious for its cluster of Sami residents, Istanbul's underbelly of drug dealers, pimps, and transvestite prostitutes. They used to live here, all of them, in the flats where, later, we would live. This used to be their street. Now, only a few remain and remember. Madame Turkan lives in a dingy basement room with bare walls and meager furnishings. Six other transvestites, much younger, sit on their haunches and listen to her respectfully. Turkan has been living on the street for more than 30 years. She knows its stories. She blames the transvestites themselves for their expulsion from the street.
"We should behave well," I told them. "We shouldn't lose these houses." But they didn't behave well. They kept on showing their bodies in the windows. So they were kicked out of those houses.
Istanbul police broke down doors and forced them out. Those who resisted were beaten with hoses.
They were kicked out of those houses onto the street, and on the streets, they had to hitchhike. They began to do prostitution on the roadsides.
During the years to follow, our street boat took on yet another group of passengers. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, a large number of jobless people, especially women, found their way to Kazanji from Russia, Ukraine, Romania, Moldavia. Some were transients. Others came to stay, working as dancers in glitzy nightclubs. The flow of women from the ex-Soviet Union coincided with the flow of students from Central and North Africa. And this went hand in hand with migration from the little towns in the province of Anatolia, coming to the big city for better jobs and living standards. I now stand at the end of Kazanji, near the bottom of the street and its second grocery store. Here there are no beer cans, no rakı, the Turkish brandy. This is Gülsüm, the conservative grocer. She's from Anatolia too.
I don't get out and encounter other people much. The ones I do see, the ones I talk to are fine. There is no problem with them, thanks be to God. Since I don't go anywhere else, I don't know. I just go from here to home each day.
The differences between ethnic, religious or sexual minorities have been sharply drawn throughout the history of the street of cauldron makers. And yet, there came a time when such differences entirely lost their meaning, the night of the earthquake in the summer of 1999. Only on that night, only when there were survivors in a shared misfortune, did the conservative grocer on Kazanji offer a cigarette to an aging transvestite and an old Greek neighbor, and they all smoked their cigarettes together. Even so, the very next day, the ground had settled again, and old boundaries were quickly redrawn.
Because you can't get along with everyone. Some people have lost themselves. You can't be close to whoever you meet. Allah will not come to them. That's the way it is.
Yani böyle. That's the way it is. Thus they and their stories came and went. The Armenians, the Greeks, the transvestites, the Africans, the Russian working girls. All these people seem to have but one thing in common. All have been fleeting passengers of the street of cauldron makers. And then, in the late 1990s, artists, musicians, bohemians, activists, feminists boarded our street boat, carrying a new set of stories. I came here around the same time. I'm inside a coffee house on Kazanji. At one table, I noticed a hippie-like woman playing dominoes alongside Kurdish revolutionaries and the pizza boy. These new groups are open-minded, critical, and they have the will to coexist in a way their grandfathers didn't. They only know Kazanji as it is today. Their eyes are fixed on the future. Outside again, in the sudden silence that envelops the street, I breathe in the smell that follows a torrent of rain. I wrote a novel here on Kazanji. On the fringes of the book is an old woman who secretly collects the artifacts that the other residents are so eager to discard. Sometimes I liken my writing to walking on a pile of rubble. Atop the pile I stop and listen for the sounds of breathing amid the stones. Perhaps this is what the saint at the top of the street was trying to tell us. Look to the stories beneath your feet.
That was Elif Shafak in Istanbul. It was produced by Sandy Tolan and Melissa Robbins of Homelands Productions. For more information, visit homelands.org. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.